Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is the problem of colonizing languages? Our guest host, David Lloyd, speaks with a world-renowned Kenyan novelist, playwright, poet, and influential post-colonial theorist on colonization, writing in his own language, and his incarceration and exile for political dissidents.
My name is David Lloyd, professor of English at the University of California, Riverside, and guest host for today. This show is devoted to the world-renowned Kenyan novelist, playwright, and poet, critic, and widely influential post-colonial theorist Ngugi wa Thiong'o, and to a new book of essays on his work, Ngugi in the American Imperium, edited by Timothy J. Rice for Africa World Press. I'm speaking today with Ngugi wa Thiong'o himself, along with Tim Rice and Noinoi K. Silva, Hawaiian scholar and activist, and also a contributor to the volume. And actually, in the interests of full disclosure, as they say, I should confess that I'm also a contributor to this volume. Its editor, Timothy J. Rice, is Professor Emeritus of Comparative Literature at New York University and recently a visiting scholar at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. His many books include Against Autonomy, Global Dialectics of Cultural Exchange, came out in 2002, and he's worked on both early modern Europe and Caribbean writing and culture in the present. Noinoi K. Silva is Kanaka Hawaii from Kailua, Oahu, and professor of Hawaiian and Indigenous politics in the Department of Politics and also cooperating faculty at the Kawaiolani Center for Hawaiian Language at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She's the author of Aloha Betrayed, Native Hawaiian Resistance to American Colonialism, 2004, and The Power of the Steel-Tipped Pen, Reconstructing Native Hawaiian Intellectual History, 2017, and has edited several other books. And our main guest today, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, is Distinguished Professor of Comparative Literature and English at the University of California, Irvine. Among his many writings that we may discuss on this show are Decolonizing the Mind, that came out in 1986, and Globalectics, 2012, as well as his memoir, Detained, from 1981, which was recently recast as Wrestling with the Devil. His most recent novel is Muroge wa Kakogo, published in English as Wizard of the Crow in 2004. His most recent rendering of the Kikuyu epic, The Perfect Nine, the epic of Kikuyu and Mumbi, appeared in 2019. He's been awarded numerous prestigious prizes internationally, too many to mention here. But still, this bold and all too brief summary of Ngugi's work does insufficient justice to the range of that work and the impact it's had on so many writers and critics and activists, as this new book, Ngugi in the American Imperium, testifies. It's a great honor to have you on the show, Ngugi, and welcome also to the show, Tim and Noinoi. Ngugi, your own essay in Ngugi in the American Imperium, to which I'll want to come back more than once, not least because of its fascinating and surprising account of the early influence on you of Korean writing, you give a brief account of what you describe as your colonial education in British colonial Kenya. In some ways, I'd say that that education and the damage it inflicted in Kenya as elsewhere, including my own country of Ireland, is the ground against which one could say all your work has been shaped. Many of our listeners aren't going to be familiar with how colonial education worked in British colonies, though, of course, in fact, we're all too familiar with an ongoing colonial education system here in the US. So I wondered if you could start by telling us a bit about the form that colonial education took and what you think it was designed to do to its colonized subjects.
First of all, let me thank you, all of you, for and all the contributors for the book, and especially the editor, Tim Rice. You know, he's complete, he's untiring, you know, he's tireless in his pursuit of what he wants to do, but particularly in that particular book, he kept on persisting and so on and so on, and at long last, it's out with all the great contributors, and I really appreciate Now, colonial education, the one thing I'm very clear about colonial education is actually the language issue. And I'm glad you mentioned Ireland, because I've come to appreciate Irish history from the language perspective. And I'm always making references to Ireland because I see so many parallels, yeah. But what I've arrived at is this, that in every colonial situation, the colonized impose their language on the colonized. And not just impose their language, they make sure there is negation of the language of the colonizer. So it's not a question of you get colonizer language, that's fine. I mean, there's neither, I mean, it's a language is a language. If it's English, it's English. But it's not just that. It went hand in hand with the negation of the language of the colonized. So where glory was associated with the language of the colonizer, call it gory, blood, gory was associated with the language of the colonized. Yeah. And this is true, I think, nearly everywhere. Whether you think of Ireland, Native American, Maori people, Hawaiian people. The Hawaiian case is very interesting because their language was vibrant and then it this very last century beginning and then stopped. And it was unbanned, I think, in 1975 or thereabout. You know, but anyway, whether Maori people, Australian peoples, you know, when Japan colonized Korea, you found this exact same pattern. Elevate Japanese language and denigrate the Korean languages and names. Yeah. So yes, you find the same pattern everywhere. So to me, you have to see one thing that's common in all colonial situations is the language question. Yeah.
Well, that's really at the center of what we'll be talking about, I think, today. And I'm sort of very struck myself by the parallels that you mentioned between a place like Ireland that was colonized by the British and Kenya, which is perhaps quite a surprising connection to be able to make. But right. Certainly in Ireland also, not only did people learn English in order to, you know, be part of the society and to run their businesses and so forth, but also the writers tended to write in English. Mm-hmm. And if I can go back to your early career, your first novels were written in English, and then in part because of the really fervent debates at the time among African writers about which language you should write in, whether English or French or Portuguese, as opposed to the indigenous languages, you actually made the step of choosing to write in your own native language, Kikuyu. Can you tell us a bit more on what motivated that choice, which to many might seem like a way to isolate yourself and to cut your writing off from reaching this wonderful global audience that everybody wants?
I know. I've heard all those arguments. When I took that decision, I was told by friends, publishers, you have a global audience. Why do you want to suddenly get off the stage of global renown? Right? And that's because I first wrote my three novels, The River Between, Weep Not Child, A Grain of Wheat, and Petals of Blood, were all written in English. So I was quite well known by my English rendering of my books all over. So my publishers were telling me, now, look at what you're going to lose. That kind of thing, you know. But I persisted. One, two things happened in my life, by the way. It did not just happen like that. for many years, actually, I had written about the language issue, but not in a manner that said, I, Gogi, have the responsibility of doing something about it or showing the way. But then is what happened. Let me just quickly narrate what happened. In 1976 or 77, I and a few friends, like the late Ngugi Mwerere, who were then working at the University of Nairobi, decided to start a community theater in the village. And the question is this, if you do community theater in a village, in what language you are going to involve the people? They are going to be part of this grand theater among the people. What language do you use? You know, and obviously it was quite clear right from the beginning that you use the language used by the people. And you, the comers from Nairobi for university, cannot come and impose your English on. It should be the other way around. That now we learn or improve our language. So that's when we decided to do the play, which came to be called Almaro When I Want, or in Gikuyu Ngahika Deda. We did Gikuyu because the participants were peasants of the village, and some workers in factories around, plantation workers. You know, I mean, they were literally regular people, peasants and workers, literally. Some of them have not been to school. But it turned out to be an eye-opener for me as a university intellectual. It's like you realize, oh my God, the kind of education I was getting so far had the effect of alienating me from the community from which I come. And so for me, working in Kamerido was a learning exercise.
Yeah, that reminds me of the Philippine historian Renato Constantino, who has a book called The Miseducation of the Filipino, talking about both Spanish and American education. Very much the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's common everywhere. It was a turning point is when later the play was stopped by an African government. I was arrested and put in a maximum security prison by an African government.
Well, explain that to me. I mean, I understand that you were engaged in a community theater project. First of all, the play was banned, and then you were imprisoned, as you're saying, in a maximum security prison. What on earth could have been so threatening to a post-colonial state and its political class in a community theater's play?
Don't forget, if I can add, forget that the place that it was actually performed was razed by the same government.
Razed to the ground.
Oh, yes, litter to the ground. Actual theater space itself was erased to the ground. Now, you ask a question, why would an African government, in my case, a Koyo language speaking president, ban a play written in Gikuyu when he had not done anything but my publications in English, which were equally critical of the existing government or their practices anyway, but suddenly the one thing written in Gikuyu seemed to be they acted as if it was a threat to them. What was that thing? Language. So when I was in prison, I was thinking about, I asked myself those questions. And so it's very clear to me that language was at the heart of the reactions of the Kenyan government, an African government. They did nothing when I wrote critical material in English, very swift to act. When it was a play, not even as critical, but in a Gikuyu language, in an African language, yeah. And this brought about my change, quite frankly. My epiphany really happens not in Camarillo, but actually in prison.
In prison, you wrote your first novel in Gikuyu. Excuse me if I mispronounce the Gikuyu, but Kaitani Mutarabaini, translated into English as The Devil on the Cross. And you mention in your essay in Ngugi in the American Imperium that your publisher was nearly abducted and violently attacked. And then you learned, at least while you were out of the country, fortunately, while launching the English translation of this book, that your own life would be in danger if you came back. Yeah. And since then, you've lived in exile in Europe and mostly in the United States. And indeed, the fact that you are still strictly an exile rather than emigrant was, if I may say so, proven by the unspeakably violent assault that you and your wife suffered when you recently did try to return to Kenya. So this is real exile and not, you know, happy migration to a better world.
The problem,
but especially for a writer whose works are as committed to their native culture as yours are, exile must be a difficult and a painful experience. And I wondered if you could talk about how it's impacted your work and your many projects, but both the critical and the creative ones, and whether it's fed that work or hindered that work, or how you think about the relationship between exile and writing.
I'm very lucky in my exile years. First, I got a job at Yale. I was living in England without a job. Then Yale invited me to what turned out to be a four-year term as a visiting professor. And then Tim Rice here decided to do one better. He did everything he could to lure me to New York University.
And succeeded.
And succeeded, of course, yeah. He did everything, including, if I remember right, sending, I think, a photocopy of a book on my publications.
And then it wasn't a photocopy. I went and took it from the reference part of the library at NYU and walked over to his office and threw it on his desk because he was asking me for Googie's CV. So I said, we'll go one better here. This is just one of the volumes on his work. And the other thing I think was Googie said, I will only come if you will finance for, let's say, for 3 years, starting with, if you will finance the Gikuyu Journal Mutiri, which I want to create. And I convinced them, that was the part that took the most convincing, that they needed to, they should come up with the money for a Gikuyu. They said, it's a waste of time. Who's going to read a Gikuyu journal? I said, well, first of all, Gikuyu readers. And they said, but how many are there? I said, well, you start off with 6 million. Will that be enough of an audience for you? Anyway, so they actually did put the money into it. And the rest of it is history because it became extraordinarily successful.
I want to be very grateful because the first time we had a modern journal in a Gikuyu language in the West, right?
Let me follow up on this in a second, but first I need to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholars Circle at scholarscircle.org. I'm David Lloyd, and we're discussing the book Ngugi in the American Imperium with Ngugi wa Thiong'o at the University of California, Irvine, Noinoi Silva at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, and Timothy Rice of New York University. The story of the resistance of the university to these hires.
In fairness, really, it wasn't the university, it was the English department.
Well, I was going to say, English department in particular really goes back to something, Ngugi, that you've always emphasized from your own work at the University of Nairobi in transforming the English curriculum that you describe in Decolonizing the Mind, along through to Globalectics, your 2012 book. Is really about the forging of connections or networks among multiple sites and cultures that English departments and others often cast as peripheral or marginal, which means mostly formerly colonized places. And I wondered if you could explain what you mean by globalectics and what's the importance of this kind of creation of networks that bypass those colonizing centers of power, you know, not going through LAX or Heathrow, but going through interconnections through nodes with one another.
That is one of the interesting ironies of the narrative the team gave us was the fact that Kamau Brathwaite was the first visitor to the Department of Literature, which we had changed the name from English to Department of Literature. And Kamau Brathwaite was the first from the Caribbean to be our visitor. Because, okay, the Nairobi department was based on the question, if you are in Kenya or in Africa, what is the center of your being? Okay. In other words, put simply, if you are studying literature, shouldn't you start with literature with Kenya, Africa at the center, then bring in Caribbean, African American, Asian, Latin American, and then European literature? In other words, you have Africa at the center, then you get other circles of connections, okay, all the way. In other words, we are not rejecting English literature. That was the connection. What's the center of our being? Because you could extend the same thing to Hawaii. Even Hawaii, what should you start with? It's not African literature, you start with Hawaiian literature. Then you go on connecting until you come to Africa, Europe, and so on, okay? So the same idea was the center, and the center and the periphery in a connected kind of way, okay? That was the thinking. What we did not realize that, and we wrote a paper called On the Abolition of the English Department.
Great title.
Yeah, it was sort of, but we don't really mean abolition of English literature, really, of the department as then structured. Because it was to be absurd. You're in Africa, and Shakespeare and Dickens are the center of your being. So you don't even study African literature at all, right? And you're in Africa, right? But we're seeing the other way around. Start from where you are, and this really was a big revolution, not only for me in terms of department, but also for me, my thinking became very, very important, you know. And it's what, when I came to from New York University and got a new job at University of California, Irvine, part of what attracted me to Irvine was heading a center for languages called International Center for Writing and Translation. So for me, this was like, okay, this is an opportunity for me to theorize in a practical way what I've been thinking about languages and their relationship, okay? So when I came to Irvine as a founding director, I asked myself, if I believe in Kenya being Kenya being the center, right? But what about when I'm in Irvine? What's the center? Who should apply, right? I can't come to Irvine and start with Kenyan literature or Kenyan writers or African languages. So he said, of course, the center in Irvine is Native American languages. That was, wait a minute, the center here is Native American languages. And that's why we brought our first event on the campus. It's something which had never happened before in University of California. Bring together Native American writers, including Hawaiian writers. So it was incredible on the campus getting Native American writers and Hawaiian writers together as the founding base of our center. And from there, of course, we brought in the question of African-American speech on American culture. And then we went on outside We brought in Icelandic writers, we brought in African writers, or question of African languages, Asian languages. In other words, in a few years, we had covered circles around the whole world.
Don't forget Irish.
Irish works also.
Well, you had Nuala, Nuala and
Ndogono. We brought Nuala also. We brought in conversation all these languages. And I'm saying this because I want to come to globalistics. The organizing principle, which always we had developed from Nairobi, was this: simply from here, where I am, whatever I am, to there and back. But of course, in a dialectical way. Because the more I know of here, the more it helps me to understand there. And the more I know of there, the more it might help me to look at my here differently. So it's dialectical, but it has to start with here, where I am, my language, my my geography, my history, and then connect with other languages, with other histories, and so on. But they also, that impact each other. That's why I call it that process. When I give my lectures at the same university, those lectures had the name, eventually when they were published, they had the name Globalectics. You're in Hawaii, you can reach the stars, right? You can reach the universe. I mean, wherever you are, you can start where you are. And I get over excited about this, but it's true. It's very simple.
I did want to come back on that notion of the connectivity that's in globalectics. And in your own essay, Ngugi, you comment that ancient epics and mythologies are conscious of the mutually transforming effects of the interaction between human, animal, plant life, water, earth, and sky. And you say, I like the idea and knowledge that we're all connected. And I know this is something that is deeply embedded in indigenous languages. And Noinoi, I wanted to bring you in here to ask whether that resonates for you, that sense that the globalectic is not just between human society here and human society there, but also a kind of a way in which these languages that colonialism seeks to kind of abolish and suppress are part of ecologies and ecologies that represent alternative potentialities. And I know you've done so much work with Native Hawaiian language, and I'm wondering if that resonates for you, what Ngugi says here.
Thank you. I would first like to say that the text, Globalectics, the book itself, is really inspiring and has inspired me to think about what we're doing with our language in a different way. And actually, the beginning of the book where you sort of, first I'm thinking, okay, he's gonna structure this around Hegel. Why is he doing this? And I realize you're just taking Hegel apart, of course. So coming from that hierarchical idea and then going into the global, you know, basing it on the shape of the globe, so that it's non-hierarchical, and the ways that, you know, basically what you did earlier in your career with changing the English department to the Department of Literature is making it so things ripple out like that. So this idea has made me realize something about my study of the Hawaiian language newspapers, because we've got basically two different kinds of literature in those Hawaiian language newspapers between, say, they didn't start in the late 1850s, but literature kind of started in the late 1850s and then up to the 1940s. So there's basically two things. There's our own literatures from our oral tradition, right, that have then been written and elaborated into, you know, long written epics and that. And then there's this other literature that's translated, and it's translated from all kinds of different languages. Mostly from English, but from French, from German, from Arabic. And so many scholars like me that are really interested in reclaiming and figuring out how to understand what our ancestors were writing about in Hawaiian, we're trying to understand our own, the thought, the philosophies, the cultures of our own ancestors, we kind of ignore those translated writings. why do I want to read about Kenneth of Scotland in Hawaiian? But after, you know, thinking about this and, you know, your body of work and thinking about it in that way, I realized that if I don't pay attention to those things, then I'm missing a whole side of my own ancestors, right? They weren't satisfied with hearing their own story. They loved their own stories. Obviously, we all love our own stories. They wanted to hear all these other stories too. And so they were deeply committed to translation. In the world of our ancestors, everything is alive. People and animals can talk to each other. We're related to the landscape. Hiiaka in the Pele epic, you know, always chants her greetings to the landscape and different forms of landscape with chant back to her. And so these things are quite alive. And I'll say one more thing and then I'll stop talking. But there's an exciting new book out called Remembering Our Intimacies by Jamaica Haole Mele Kaleni Osorio, a junior colleague in my department. I'm extremely proud and thrilled to say, which theorizes anew about our relationships with each other, our relationships with our other than human kin in the landscape based on this mo'olelo of Hiiaka and the various things. But she also reviews, or what are called queer relationships in English, but are not queer in our ancestral culture. So it's one of the reasons I'm excited about it, even though I'm not technically a literature scholar, this is another huge leap forward in the study of Hawaiian literature in Hawaiian. It's a book written in English, but it just pushes it another whole level up, how you can read our ancestral literature written in Hawaiian, what it means to us and all of that. So
that's great, Nona, because I mean, one of the things I was trying to get at here is that when Ngugi writes about colonialism as a cultural bomb in decolonizing the mind, it does go to the way in which the imposition of a colonial language is destructive, not only of the language itself, but also it's part of an attempt to destroy a whole kind of human ecology of relations to the world, because a language actually, you know, embeds an ethic and a set of possibilities for imagining that world. And I know, I mean, you have done all this amazing work yourself on retrieving early newspaper and other print writings that were in Hawaiian. And I wanted to ask, in doing a project like that, you kind of indicate that you were really influenced by decolonizing the mind and its entry into Hawaiian intellectual circles and indigenous circles soon after it was published, I think. And I'm wondering, how does it happen that a book written by a Kenyan writer would have this kind of impact in the Pacific? And I know it's also had a huge impact amongst the Maori in Aotearoa. And I'm just wondering if you can give some explanation of how that cultural translation can take place.
Well, it's in the lingua franca of English.
Well, that's the mechanical reason, but the resonance is what I'm interested in.
That's the irony of it all. From my perspective, the way I came to know about this work was, of course, through amazing work of Haumani K. Trask. And her essay in this volume, of course, made me cry a lot for a lot of reasons. We just lost her in July. I think she was responsible for bringing you here first, Gugi, if I'm not mistaken. And then she always taught that book and other books of yours. And I actually wasn't a student of hers. I was on the language side, she was teaching Hawaiian studies. And for some reason, I didn't take a class from her. But it ripples out too. So there are other people that had taken classes from her, and somebody gave me the book or told me to get the book. And it was deeply influential on me. And so I would love to hear Googie's story of how he and his work came to Hawaii first and several times.
I'm glad you mentioned Haunani, plus I didn't know she has passed on, but she has become very important in my life. Because we met in Washington State. It's a famous college which had invited her and me at the same time. And that's why we met for the first time. I think that's when she came to know about decolonizing the mind. We just felt like we knew each other for a long time. Yeah, that's how it was, you know, with her. And I think she took back decolonized the mind to Hawaii. So she's really the one who spread the book. Of course, later they invited me to Hawaii. But in terms of the Pacific as a whole, I suspect Haunani had heard about me in connection with my lectures in New Zealand. Because the lectures, which became the book, Decolonizing the Mind, were first given in New Zealand, in what also turned to have been Maori Language Week. So that's when I first articulated in a consistent manner these ideas that I had developed in prison in Kenya, but not in a book form. So lecture form. Now, what I found very interesting, there were four lectures. First lecture, there were very few Pacific peoples or Maori peoples. They were just university people. Second lecture, word had gone out. So there are more Maori people and more Pacific coming to the university, probably for the first time, and occupying the space. That lecture, there were even more people from the Pacific. Fourth lecture was very dramatic, because one Maori activist took over the stage and he said, these are our lectures, not yours. They call white people back, whatever they call white people in New Zealand, not for you people, it's ours. And he started, he said, of course I was a bit embarrassed because I didn't know what was going on. So he started conducting, he became the master of ceremonies. The Maori guy, yes, and then you, and then. But toward the end, something happened which I always remember, really, and I always say it. There's a little girl, Maori, I think. She brought a gourd with Maori type of markings, and she gave it to me, and she said, you don't even have to know my name, but I want you to know that you were not talking about Kenya. You were talking about us, Maori people. I'll never forget that sentence. And she went away. It's not as if she was part of the conversation, but she just wanted me to know that one.
I think that goes a long way to explaining your impact in the Pacific region. And I have to say, in Ireland as well. And I know in many other places, including, of course, the United States. I need to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholars Circle at scholarscircle.org. I'm David Lloyd, and we're discussing the book Ngugi in the American Imperium with Ngugi Wa Thiong'o at the University of California, Irvine, Noinoi Silva at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, and Timothy Rice of New York University. Actually, this brings me back to you, Tim, as the editor of the book. And of course, in your own essay, you emphasize the relevance of Ngugi's thinking about colonial repression of languages, not only in British colonies, but also in the United States. I did want to ask you as editor, as we're talking about this new book, Ngugi and the American Imperium, first to say thanks for this wonderful volume that you and Africa World Press have produced. But I also want to ask, why this particular title? Why Ngugi in the American Imperium? And what does that signify for you?
Actually, that's a question you could ask Noe Noe. Because when I asked Noe Noe if she would write something for us, and Noe Noe said this, Hanani hadn't said this years back, because originally the title was going to be Ngugi in the Americas. As time went on, and time, when Ngugi said it's been a long time in the making, it's true. It was originally planned for your 65th birthday, Ngugi, so it's been a long time in the works. All kinds of life things intervene. But it was, and of course, the title Ngugi in the Americas became 4-1 anyway because of the people who were able to participate and the people who weren't able to participate and so forth. But Noe Noe said to me, I will certainly participate, but not in a book entitled Ngugi in the Americas, because Hawaii is not in the Americas. And I talk about this a little bit, as you know, in the introduction.
Right.
And it made for a slight, I've often thought now that it should be called Ngugi in the US Imperium rather than Ngugi in the American Imperium. But by the time it got to that point, it was already too late for all kinds of reasons. And since the whole objective was to try and get people who would be writing about Ngugi writing in a way, his being in the US and the consequences of that for people who are working in the US or in areas that are profoundly impacted by some of the worst aspects, as well as some of the good aspects, but worst aspects of US imperialism. So the US Imperium, the American Imperium, became a way to incorporate the political side of things, because obviously geographically and in culturally and so forth, Hawaii is not part of the Americas or indeed in any sense whatsoever. Politically, of course, sadly, you are. And it seemed to me that a title like that grasped that point. And it also, I think, grasped the point for people working, from Caribbean people, for obvious reasons, and also for people working in Canada. And it would have done had we had anyone who could, from Central America or South America, who was able to participate. But for one reason or another, that didn't work out. You know, these things, as you know, are often accidental in the ways of who gets involved and who doesn't. But to make it clear in the title that we're talking about an oppressive system, an imposed system, and that Ngugi's work is a way of responding to that, not least because you are now living and working in the United States. So that's how that title came about. Under the pressure of Noe Noe saying, no, I won't unless you will.
Well, it's great to know that back history. But Tim, the other question I wanted to ask you about the book, which includes a remarkable number of essays and also a very impressive range of contributors, which is unusual in what might seem to some as a scholarly book, because it's not only literary critics and postcolonial theorists, but you also have visual artists, you have poets and playwrights and performance artists. And indeed, in most cases, both artists and critics also overlap with being activists of one kind or another. And then, of course, you've included Native American writers, and as you were saying, people from the Caribbean and Canada and Hawaii, as well as the United States. And I just wondered how you came up with this quite remarkable cast of contributors.
Well, some was simply response. People said, yes, I'm willing to do it. But mostly I was looking for people who I knew had been impacted in one way or another fairly considerably by Ngugi's work. I didn't necessarily want people who were working in the United States, but people who in one way or another had been, whose work had been, or whose lives indeed have been seriously impacted by that American Imperium. And this is another reason why I left American finally, because if you say American and Imperium in the same sentence, it's obvious to what you're referring. You're obviously not referring to Brazil. But as far as the cast is concerned, as I say, partly accidental, a lot of friends involved, which I suppose is often how these things work. It's in fact, Noe Noe's inclusion is, we became friends afterwards. In fact, it was because I happened to get hold of her steel pen and loved the book and said, here's someone who has to be in this book. So it's a lot of accidents involved, a lot of persuasion in some cases, people I really wanted to have in who were resistant in one way or another, or who simply said they don't have time. I mean, a lot of people whom I did ask simply said I couldn't, which just turned out probably just as well. When you were talking about the globalectic nature of exchanges and the importance of language in this, because one of the things I really would like to make a point about is one of the reasons I think that Googie has had such an impact, I don't want to embarrass you, is a simple matter of what I would refer to as generosity. Googie is enormously generous. And I was just recently rereading, for reasons I won't even go into, Edward Said's Freud and the Non-European, which is, if you haven't read it, it's well worth it. It's a wonderful lecture in which it's really a kind of an analysis of Moses' monotheism and his argument that the whole Jewish tradition is based on the fact of coming out of Moses, who wasn't Jewish, he was Egyptian, so that everything Jewish comes out of Egypt and so forth. One point he makes, he doesn't do an analysis, but he gives an argument about why we should not go along with Achebe's dismissal of Conrad as simply racist and therefore someone we shouldn't read law. He does what Googie is apt to do. And he tells us in no uncertain terms over a couple of pages of what isn't actually a very long lecture, why in fact everyone should be reading Conrad and why Conrad is part of the ongoing conversation as well. And why what a classic is someone whom you can reread in endlessly different ways. And I'm struck because Googie himself, you probably forgot you even wrote it, but a review of a book on Joseph Conrad in the New York Times Book Review, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of years back, in which you argued that we actually need to read Conrad for the same reason we need to read any great writer, because he speaks to us all in very different ways and enables us more to create exchanges with one another that aren't exclusive, that are inclusive, and that he too is part of that globalectic exchange of nodes. And it's only once we recognize that everyone is included who can be, that you get a true sense of what globalectics is actually all about. It's not just a relationship between Ireland and Gikuyu, or between, I'm thinking of Nuala now, who was one of the first people I know who's been translated directly from Irish into Turkish. You know, speaking of bypassing metropolitan centers for uses of language. And your argument, Googie, of course, that there are ways to use English and French and so forth that help movement from one language into another and don't try to impose themselves and replace other people's languages. I just wanted to make that point because it struck me that what you have to say about Conrad and about his participation in this global exchange between nodes is a mark of the generosity that is why you have been so important, not just in the Pacific. And we have a friend now who's from the Solomon Islands, in fact, who teaches in the history department at Hawaii, who is himself very affected by Googie's work. He's actually a legal historian, and which gives you some sense of precisely the different areas in which Googie, you've had an impact. And it's, you know, people tend to think of Googie as a literary person, a drama person, a literary critic, and so forth. Well, as what I tried to do in this collection was make it clear from the people who are participating that it's much broader than that. That what globalectics involves and what moving centers involves is in fact every aspect of culture that one can imagine.
We only have a few minutes left, Googie, yeah. But I did want to remember and to honor one of the contributors who passed away before the book was out. That's Kamau Brathwaite. And we've talked about how you met Hanani K. Trask, who we also have to lament having passed away before the book came out. But in the case of Brathwaite, whose own phrase tidalectics resonates very nicely with globalectics. Tim tells the story of how you actually brought a poet who was then called Edward Brathwaite to the university in Nairobi as one of the first guests, and certainly the first guest from the Caribbean, and that it was actually your mother who gave him the name of Kamau, I think. So I wondered if, Ngugi, if you have a moment, you could just tell us a little bit about that encounter and its importance.
May I jump in for just a second here?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, because I was going to say that, in fact, Ngugi knew Kamau actually from London in the 1960s. And, you know, when Kamau was Kamau, of course, one of the three founders of the Caribbean artist movement. And at their first meetings in London, which I think took place in 1966, it happened that Ngugi at the time was in Leeds working on a PhD actually on Lamming. It was his original intention. He was writing a dissertation on Lamming, which he eventually dropped because he became more interested in being a writer. And but he was, Ngugi was at those first meetings of the of the Caribbean Artist Movement. And I don't know if that's the first time, Ngugi, that you knew Edward Lawton, as he then was.
Yes, and Ngugi, tell us a bit about that first meeting, just to end, because I think it, although, you know, we could do a whole show, both on separate shows on Hanani K. Trask and on Kamau Brathwaite, I think the fact that his poem, Jam Music, opens the volume is very appropriate. So
I hoped it was, that's why I did it. It's a heavily revised version of it, of course, in his Sycorax style.
Ngugi, over to you.
We met in Orlando Patterson's house when he was a young lecturer in London University. So I remember that evening when we all met there. That was the beginnings, literally, of the Caribbean arts movement. And that's also how I later came to know, but the person who reconnected us all was John La Rose, who owned a bookshop in North London, and it was a kind of intellectual center.
So that's what I met. Founders of the movement.
All that, again, dialectics, one thing leading to another. Eh? I mean, Caribbean, then later he's our guest at Nairobi, and my mother, and he changed his name from Edward to Kamau in Kenya, right? As an encounter with my mother. So to see my mother was now his mother. So very interesting.
Well, let's hope that the dialectics will continue and that we'll be able to devote a whole show to Kamau's work.
Can I say one thing?
Yes, please.
I use Hegel dialectics because it's very, very important. Dialectics, the dialectical way of thinking. That was important for me. Although everything a lot about his artist to Africa, everything is disgusting. But the other person I would like to mention is this English poet, Blake. Because I found that statement to see the world in a grain of sand, eternity in an hour. Oh my God. It just for me sums up everything, right?
Right.
See the world in a grain of sand, eternity in an hour. And there's another phrase I forget. Because for me, we can borrow from each other. I now read Shakespeare differently from the way I read him. My discovery of language issue for me has opened my eyes and given a new Shakespeare. Because Shakespeare was coming, and others were coming from there, when English was under the hegemony of Latin. These were writers who were discovering their language anew. They were excited that their language can do so much, when for many years, they were told Latin, you can only say so many things in Latin. So they discover, and you can see find a similar phenomenon among the early French writers. Like the one, I keep on forgetting his name, but he was about Pantagruel, Rabelais, yeah, like Rabelais. You can see, again, this is a guy who is discovering his language anew. Even if in Spanish, Cervantes, you can see the reach to their languages, people who are discovering their native languages, because for many years, those languages were under the hegemony of Imperial Rome, right? They discover their languages, and this excitement that I get myself today in writing in Gikuyu, the excitement I find Nuala in Irish, you know. And mention Nuala, I should mention that as a brilliant essay of hers of why I write in Irish. And it's in the internet, you can get it, yeah.
Yes, yes, yeah. No, indeed.
Yeah, brilliant, yeah. Yeah,
essay. Excitement is a very good one to close on, since this really is all the time we have for our discussion today. And I just want to thank you, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, both for this conversation and for the incredible contribution you've made as a novelist and a playwright and as a critic. The impact you've had is amazing, including, I have to say, so much on myself since meeting you in the mid-1980s. And I also want to thank Tim Rice, who's the editor of this amazing book, Ngugi in the American Imperium, that's been the theme of our conversation today. And Tim is the Professor Emeritus of Comparative Literature at New York University. And I also want to thank Noinoi K. Silva, who is a professor of Hawaiian and Indigenous politics in the Department of Politics and cooperating faculty at Kauaihalani Center for Hawaiian Language at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Thank you both for being on the show with us today. And we look forward to further conversation whenever it's possible.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for having us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you to our guest host, David Lloyd, and most of all to you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.